Are we podcasting now? Because I never know when we're podcasting.
I just clicked start recording, so anything's on the table now.
This is a book I have probably the most distinct memory of coming across when I was a kid.
Like, how do you mean?
Because, well, we used to... My parents used to vacation up in Michigan in the Upper Peninsula near a tiny lake called Lake Manistique.
Okay.
And it was Little Manistique. There's a big Manistique and a little Manistique, and we were by the little one. And there was nothing to do other than fish, and I wasn't big on fishing. So once every week that we were up there, we would go to the Curtis, Michigan Library. Mm-hmm. And the Curtis, Michigan Library is this one-room little library, and the children's book section was this one shelf. And I was going in expecting absolutely nothing because all the books there dated back to the 1950s. You know, they did not have a lot of money for libraries in Curtis. And there on the shelf was this book, The Mouse and the Motorcycle. And I saw it immediately that it was written by Beverly Cleary. And I did like a triple take as a kid because this made no sense to me. I thought, wait, Beverly Cleary is the one who writes all the Henry Huggins books. And this is obviously some sort of a fantasy involving animals.
Right.
And so I remember staring at the book and then taking it back. We were in cabins at the lake and reading it through. You know, as an adult, of course, it makes perfect sense to me that people can write in different modes about different things. But as a kid, it made absolutely no sense to me that Beverly Cleary would write a book like this.
Yeah, it's an odd one. It's one of the books that's always kind of been with me, like as a like part of the just the canon, the great Beverly Cleary cycle, because it was just there in the library. Like, it was a known quantity among me and my friends. And then, of course, the TV adaptation came out when I was not a little kid, but when I was young enough to still want to watch it. And so it didn't occur to me until I got considerably older how unusual a place it holds in the entire Beverly Cleary library. It's just, it really, now, I mean, of course, now as a 40-some-year-old man looking at her whole career, the three books in the Ralph S. Mouse trilogy just are these strange blips on the Beverly Cleary radar that I have trouble as a person thinking about a writing career justifying. Even with her explanation as to why the book got written in the first place, it still doesn't quite fit in with what I consider to be like logical reality.
It feels like she's writing outside of her mode.
Mm-hmm.
There is there's a kind of a dialogue that goes to this book that reminds me a lot of other models that she must have had at the time, like Robert Lawson's Rabbit Hill or other 1950s books involving animals that have this kind of a cadence where all the characters are kind of talking in this kind of a quippy, jokey, oh, come on kind of dialogue or nuts to you kind of thing, you know, that feels very odd and strange. The characters are also very abruptly rude to one another in funny ways. And the mother is constantly holding forth about, the mother mouse of Ralph Mouse is constantly holding forth about tragedies that befell the mouse family. There's this kind of this artificiality when dealing with anthropomorphized animals. But, you know, before we get too far into it, I would have to also say that when I tell people that I do a podcast on Beverly Cleary, most people will talk about Ramona, but then there will be people for whom these Ralph books are her major work.
Oh, I was going to say, I've had a couple of people now be like, ooh, when are you getting to The Mouse and the Motorcycle? Oh, have you gotten to the Ralph S. Mouse books yet? And I'm like, well, we'll get there, but wow, what a strange one to just pluck out, I guess. But there you go. Like, no one's like, ooh, socks.
Speaking of animal books, I just want to put a plug in here in case any readers out there want to set me up. When I was also at the Curtis, Michigan Library, I came across a very strange book called Rutgers and the Water Snouts.
Okay.
That I have tried all my adult life to find a copy of this book. And when I look at it online, You can find copies of it on eBay for like $500 or something like this. So anyone out there who has an extra copy of Rutgers and the Water Snouts and who doesn't want to sell it immediately for $500, please send it to me because I want to remember what this book was about.
You could do one of those old fashioned, like back when people used to trade books through the mail, like the only way to find rare books if you didn't want to buy them was just borrow them from someone you'd never met by being like, all right, just send them to me and I'll read it and I'll send it back to you. It's 1918 and this is how we do things. So maybe someone, you know, someone will take a chance and right. let you read. What is it called again?
Rutgers and the Water Snouts. If I recall, it is about a bulldog who is seeking meaning and purpose in life and he decides to find it in some sea cucumbers that he finds by the side of the ocean.
Does he go to Rutgers?
No, but that you would think that, isn't it? It's Yale that has the bulldog as the mascot. I don't know why the Rutgers is a bulldog in this
Interesting.
Book.
Oh, so that's the bulldog's name. Oh, I yes. see. Should we tell everybody what this book's about in case they haven't sat down for 20 minutes and tried to read it?
Yeah, why don't we do that thing where we stick in the first line here?
Okay, here it comes. I'll get to the beginning of my Tracy Dockray illustrated edition of
Oh God. Good
Funny
God.
Story though, illustrated by Tracy Dockray, turn to the back and it's got a 2-page note by Tracy Dockray about how Tracy Dockray did these illustrations. It's the first time I've ever come across this. I'm like, oh, you actually gave this some thought. I'm so sorry, but no, it's a whole couple of notes about how they came about to illustrate Ralph as Mouse. Anyway, Mouse and the Motorcycle. Keith, the boy in the rumpled shorts and shirt, did not know he was being watched as he entered room 215 of the Mountain View Inn. Neither did his mother and father, who both looked hot and tired. They had come from Ohio and for 5 days had driven across plains and deserts and over mountains to the old hotel in the California foothills, 25 miles from Highway 40. That's it. That's the opening paragraph.
That's it. We don't get to Ralph for, I don't know, how many, like till the next chapter, actually.
Yeah, they mention mice. They talk about mice. But yeah, Ralph doesn't pop up except until chapter 2. But you do see in the Tracy Dockray edition, at least, an illustration of Mouse, of Ralph as Mouse spying on them through his mouse hole.
Well, that is the first illustration that is that accompanies it from with the original Lewis Darling illustrations. Oh. I think quite frequently Dockery used the Darling illustrations as certainly a jumping off point. Sometimes she completely copied the basic composition of these things, or at least the subject matter. It's funny when you open this book, it feels like it's going a completely different direction. You know, it feels like it's going to be this domestic story, and it's going to be this 1960s story about people who are at this point, you know, this is written in 65. At this point, motels have taken over America and road trips are all the rage. Mm-hmm. And we have a family that has come across a quaint old hotel that dates back to a different time in a different era. And, you know, it could turn out to be The Shining, I suppose. But especially since the character of Matt is sort of like the Scatman Crothers
he
character.
He really is.
This
whole book is – the book never – because we start with such a tight focus for a whole chapter on this family and their experiences in this weird old hotel, you don't – it shifts – I'm never really sure who our hero is in this book. If we're supposed to really be rooting for Ralph or really be focusing on Keith because – each book in the Ralph S. Mouse series is about Ralph's interactions with a different boy, but it's really the boy who goes through some sort of change throughout the book, like who has to grow up a little bit or learn to kind of adjust to life. Whereas Ralph is this mouse with a very short lifespan who's just kind of trying to survive. And it's weird. Like, I'm not sure who our central figure is. And I think that comes across a little bit in the kind of like back and forth POV changing in the book.
The theme of this first chapter to me is about a hotel that's fallen on hard times.
Yeah.
And as an adult, all I can think is, wait, how can they pay for an entire staff if the only people who are showing up are people who are randomly coming down the road? We talk about The Shining. This really is like the Overlook Hotel. This is like a hotel from a different era. You know, it's a hotel from maybe the 20s, maybe the 30s. I don't know that it was a destination for people to go to be in the mountains. And now nobody wants to just go to a hotel to be to in a hotel. They want to go to a hotel on their way somewhere else. So that's what...
Well, it says here that, I mean, the... You know, the mom says that, like, that we, you know, like, this place used to be quite a hotel. Like, it used to be a destination. The father says, this used to be a fashionable hotel. People came from miles around. And the mom says, 50 years ago, and they came by horse and buggy. So it does, like, it does have that, like, is this a... Not to jump ahead too much, but the Matt, the bellboy, who's in his 60s, can talk to mice. And...
Right.
There's mouse talking all through this book, and it's never explained. There's a weird, unexplained, semi-supernatural air to this whole undertaking. There's unexplained phenomena in this book, such as a mouse being able to power an unpowered toy motorcycle with his mouth that goes unremarked upon. It's just accepted as... the plot that happens, and that's it. There's sort of suggested that it's a small boy's belief in the ability for this to happen that causes it to occur. But other than that, like the TV movie calls more attention to the oddness of Ralph being able to speak than the book does. And it just goes by in one line. So there's a weird air about this entire book that maybe a child doesn't notice as much, but I really noticed.
Oh yeah. And because the setting at the beginning is one of decay and you know, the ruin of this hotel, it feels like it always feels slightly sinister to me, like something bad could happen. And there are nods in the plot towards very bad things.
Oh, incredibly bad
towards,
things.
You know, Ralph has lost several members of his family, including
his
father.
In a horrible way.
In horrible ways. He is in constant threat to his own life in a way that you never see in a Beverly Cleary story. You never have characters who are in danger of being eaten by owls. And the boy is taken ill, and it's kind of left up to you, the reader, to determine how sick he really is. But, you know, as a kid, your imagination can run wild. The parents certainly seem crazily worried about him.
In rereading this again, because I've read it about 100 times in the last, like, year, just for various reasons, in rereading this again, it's really struck me that she does not the best job, but something of a good job at making these small events, like a boy getting a fever. For the readers at home, the listeners at home, this book is about a mouse who can power a motorcycle with his mouth, and then in the end, the whole plot hinges on whether or not he can get an aspirin to a boy with a fever. Like, that's the entire... not a whole lot happens in this book. A mouse learns how to ride a motorcycle, which belongs to a boy. He loses the motorcycle, which causes a rift between him and the boy. Because the mouse is discovered by the hotel owners, they start planning to put out traps for the mice. The boy falls ill. The mouse feels bad. They decide to help the boy by finding him an aspirin, which he can't get his hands on because it's 4th of July week and everything's closed. The mouse goes through the hotel, finds an aspirin, gets the aspirin back to the boy. The boy gives him the motorcycle. The end. Like, that's it. Like, that's all that happens. I don't think the boy was ever really in danger, because I think he just was a little sick. But because we're seeing this sort of through the eyes of a mouse, it's interesting in that I think not only is the hotel bigger and scarier than it would be to a person, but kind of the events surrounding the mice are bigger and scarier than they are to a person. Like, to the parents, it's like, oh, our son is sick and it's vacation weekend. But to a mouse, it's like these giant creatures and this boy who is enormous and powerful, like he can feed us, he can get us food, he can take care of us. The boy is ill with a fever and we must help. Like there's like everything seems grand and grandiose. And like just the mouse's job is simply to get downstairs. And to a human, that's nothing. But to a mouse, that's an enormous undertaking. And it involves like him getting trapped under a glass and flung out a window and scurrying across the floor and getting attacked by a dog. Like that's a big deal. And I think it's interesting that Beverly Cleary kind of manages to make it seem that way. Although also after there are set pieces in this that go on for pages that are somewhat tiresome upon reading. Sorry, I just had to rant for a second.
It is a kind of an unevenly paced book, partly because, as you say, the plot itself is very simple. So a lot of the book is taken up with these set pieces, these little... the Ralph has to outsmart the dog in one of the rooms, or Ralph gets caught by this pair of... Now, are they're girls or are they women?
I think it's two girls, because one said, I'll take him into my kindergarten class.
Right. Two girls. And strangely enough, when he talks to them, they can't understand
because they're dirty girls.
That's actually the reason Beverly Cleary gives that they can't understand
which
him.
Which is one of the first clues. Well, not the first. Okay. It's not the first clue at all. It's like the millionth clue in this book, that this book was written for boys to read. Because she makes a huge deal throughout this book that boys are interested in cars and Ralph can talk to the boy because boys want to talk to mice and they can connect because they're both interested in cars because they're both boys. And then finally when the girls capture Ralph, he's just like, they're like, oh, he's squeaking. And she's like, yeah, they can't understand him because they're just dumb old girls.
There are these set pieces like that. There's a long piece where he is trying to escape the maid's vacuum cleaner.
Oh, did you say it was long?
It was, yes.
Oh, good. I wanted to make sure that we emphasize the word long, because it's about 100 pages long.
Yeah, it's a very long segment. This is kind of funny to say, but I got the feeling reading it that Beverly Cleary doesn't know how housework works, because the maid is doing things that make no sense.
Yes, you're exactly. She either doesn't know how housework works or just what maids do or how they function. And to drive that point home, and we'll get to this, but the TV adaptation makes even less sense.
Because a lot of it hinges on the fact that, in the book at least, it hinges on the fact that the maid has, the end has popped off of her vacuum cleaner, and instead of doing what anyone would do, which is stop and put the head back on the tube of your vacuum cleaner. This is one of those old wand vacuum cleaners that has like a long tube into a cylindrical body. She just kind of like flails it about underneath the the bed for a while, and then she leaves it running and walks off and does something else. And
yes.
I just don't understand what it's not that it just doesn't seem credible for like the way people are, you know.
It does seem credible though, in the sense that this is a filthy hotel, and you know it's filthy because the mice live almost entirely on food on the ground in the rooms, including the aforementioned aspirin, which Ralph is like, I'm gonna go find an aspirin, I'm sure I'll be able to find one on the ground somewhere. And lo and behold, he does. I'm assuming that these rooms are not vacuumed well. They are not cleaned well. I am sure that a guest is lucky if those sheets have been changed in the last couple of weeks. It's not a good hotel. And or inn, I guess it's a quaint little inn. And yeah, and the scene where he is, you think he's going to get sucked into the vacuum. He doesn't. It leads to a whole other several pages of events. But yeah, it describes like the motorcycle almost gets sucked into the vacuum, so he tries to pull it with his tail, and that doesn't work. So he tries to pull it this way, and that doesn't work. And then he tries to push it this way, and that doesn't work. And it just keeps going on. She's trying to logically build it out so that when he finally does get on the motorcycle like he promised he wouldn't do, and rides it forward like he promised he wouldn't do, he has a reason for doing that. And it's so convoluted, and it sort of shows you why Beverly Cleary didn't write a whole lot of action sequences.
Yeah. No, she's...
Especially motorcycle action sequences.
It's puzzling because Cleary, of course, is the master of following sort of internal trains of thought. You know, she's just brilliant at following a psychological state through several stages, you know,
yeah.
Like her and Shakespeare's soliloquies. I think those are the two best examples in English. But she's terrible when it comes to writing like one logical physical action after another, partly because it always feels like she has that end in mind that she needs to get to, and she will have anything happen that will propel things to that final conclusion she wants.
Yeah. And it's obvious that she said, okay, Ralph has to break his promise that he wouldn't ride the motorcycle, but I don't want him to just ride the motorcycle because that would just be him just being a jerk and breaking his promise. So she has to come up with the most convoluted way to make it happen, and also for him to get caught by losing the motorcycle. But what happens in that case then is that when it comes time for him to admit that he lost the motorcycle, he should just be able to say, I was trying to get it out of the way of a vacuum cleaner. Like, I wasn't trying to ride it. I was trying to keep it from getting destroyed. But if he did that, then there would be no tension between him and Key. Like, she's painted herself into a corner. By not wanting Ralph to appear like a thoughtless jerk, she takes all the teeth out of it and makes it somewhat really illogical.
Right. There's a lot of, in this story, people could just explain what happened.
Right.
And the other person would say, oh, that's what happened. And they would accept it and move on.
Not to mention the fact that the mom sees Ralph ride the motorcycle at one point, and that doesn't go anywhere. Like, she sees the mouse ride the motorcycle, and she's like, I just saw a mouse ride a motorcycle. And her husband's like, ah, women. And like,
yeah, there's a lot of that, yeah. of these things that don't go anywhere. The character of Matt, I think, is the perfect example of that, because as the only adult in this book, well, I mean, there's only two people in this book who can talk to a mouse. There's Keith, the child, and Matt, the adult. You think that there's going to be some sort of strange parallel that's going to be developed about Matt's, you know, oh, when I was a child, I came here and I talked to a mouse or something, yeah. like that. Or there's going to be some mystical explanation for what he's going to do. Or at least by dint of the fact that he is able to talk to Ralph, you would think he'd be a more important character than he is.
Right.
But he shows up at the beginning. He like has one word with Matt, with Ralph, like somewhere around halfway through the book, and then he shows up at the end to say, "Oh, I found the motorcycle."
Yeah. He lets Ralph into a door at one point. He's like, "Oh, this door get locked? Sorry." And then he opens it up. Yeah, and then at the end, he's like, "I found a motorcycle," but like he didn't even have to know the mouse could talk. He already knew that the boy owned a motorcycle. Like, he could have just found them. Like, anyone would have found that motorcycle and been like, "It probably belongs to the only boy in the hotel. There's two guests. It probably belongs to that boy."
Right, but if this is a fantasy for children, there is a strong draw to the idea. When you're a kid, you love to read stories where the kid is smarter than the parents, or at least the kid has a secret that the parents don't
yeah.
have. And so there is a kind of an interesting bridge between Keith and Matt. You know, they share a secret,
yeah.
and they're kind of in cahoots with each other, but they aren't in cahoots that much. It's not like they don't have like lots of hijinks together. It's like nothing really ends up amounting to much.
Right. Like they never have like a heart to heart or anything. Like it sort of seems like at some point there should be that scene where Matt's like, yeah, it's pretty hard growing up or something. Like, Keith and Ralph end up having a pretty nice scene, a very Beverly Cleary-esque, I am insightful as to the way kids operate scene, where Ralph and Keith talk about how hard it is to want to grow up and be taken seriously. But, you know, they keep doing things that show their parents they're not quite ready to grow up yet. It's a nice little moment. It takes like a page and a half, and it's a very Beverly Cleary-esque scene that could have happened with Matt or something, or Matt could have narrated the book maybe and been like, I'm Matt, and I've been trapped in this hotel for 200 years, and boys come and go, and I can talk to all the animals. Like, something, or like...
I made a wish on a motorcycle.
Like, let me tell you about when I arrived at this hotel and have been stuck in this time loop. I used to be called Keith. Like, I don't know, like, something, because Matt does stick around for three novels, and he's sort of there, but he never takes, he never steps out and is, like, front and center. He's just always, like, the old man who knows that boys can talk to mice, and that's it. Like, he doesn't really help out. He doesn't do anything. Like, spoiler alert, but yeah. don't get too emotionally invested in Matt, because he's not going anywhere.
If this book does have any theme, it is about the longing for grown-up responsibility. You know, the big tension of the book is Ralph ready for a motorcycle? Is he responsible enough to be trusted with a motorcycle? He does things that seem foolhardy. He bends one of the handlebars. He loses the motorcycle. In the end, he shows that he is responsible by
yes
finding a dirty old ass and bringing it up to Keith. But the thing that's kind of poignant about this is as you mentioned before, the mouse has, you know, the mouse mentions quite frequently, oh, we grew up much faster than you. And there is this kind of a finitude to the mouse's life. I mean, there's a finitude to Keith's life, to all of our lives. And you keep feeling like, in the way that the motorcycle is sort of a miniature bit of humanity, and we're looking at this mouse as this miniature of the human condition, there is a kind of a way that this could almost be a sort of an existential reflection. You know, it's all happening in this hotel that is literally falling apart around them, but it never does. You never quite reaches over into that moment where Cleary is going to like really put a pin in it. Maybe that's because I think with her the things that she writes for boys especially, she resists that temptation. She doesn't want to give morals to her stories for boys, I think. I think that she's mostly interested in writing a story that's interesting.
Well, I was actually, I made a note of that very thing because about the fact that this book gets weirdly existential, but also that she gives, it's on this reading, I was like, it feels like she gave the role of responsibility in growing up to Ralph, and she had all the discussions about that happen between Keith and Ralph. Because if she had tried to write this book about a boy going through this stuff, and it had that discussion happen between, say, the boy and Matt, or a parent, or a friend, it would have seemed very, like, pedantic and manipulative, very typical, like, it's just another, you made me read a book about responsibility and how hard it, like, oh man, like, I wanted to read a, like, I'm feeling lectured to by the author. But by giving it to a mouse and sort of having it several degrees removed from reality, it's about the universal desire for an animal that only lives a couple of years to ride a motorcycle. Like, that's so bizarre that she's able to sort of couch a lot of her, like, preaching in this unusual setting. So, like, a kid can read this and kind of feel like, okay, like, I don't feel so talked down to, because it's a mouse talking to a boy about something stupid. Like, I don't know, I feel it, in that sense, this kind of does work for me.
I find this extremely charming. I find it extremely weird.
It's very
weird.
I don't find
parts of it successful that I wish would be successful, but as an entertainment for children, it really gets under the skin. I can see why so many people remember this book from their childhood, because it's such an odd book.
Well, and there's some weird stuff between Ralph and Keith. Like, there's a weird almost mutual resentment between the two of them. Like, it never really gels as a friendship. Like, Keith seems to be jealous that Ralph's able to ride a motorcycle. But Ralph seems to be just jealous that Keith is able to be autonomous, like, be able to just sort of do things. And there is a little bit of resentment between them in their dialogue, in this kind of just like, well, you're able to do this and you're able to do that. And in the end of the book, like, you realize, oh, Keith's going away. He's leaving Ralph forever. This isn't like a solid friendship. And Ralph's just going to become a school essay that Keith has, like, a great idea about. Like, at the end of this book, it basically just becomes Keith being like, well, see ya, I guess I'll write a paper about you. Like, not to, like, dismiss, like, not to diminish what they have between them, but there's a fleeting quality to their friendship that I think's deliberate, because Ralph's stuck in this hotel, like, and boys are just going to come and go, and Ralph is always going to be here. As far as we know, he's always going to be in this hotel. He's going to live. And he says in the book, "I always thought I'd die in this hotel." Like, that's it. This is his life.
The other thing that Ralph longs for is when you say that he thought he was going to die in this hotel, that's in the context of he's overhearing the two girls say, oh, they're going to take them back with them to their kindergarten. And where were they from? There was, like, I forget where they were from. They were from not Ohio, but somewhere far out there. But Wichita. They were going to go back to Kansas, and so there is a desire Ralph has for wide open spaces. But on the other hand, if he leaves the hotel, he's immediately in danger of owls,
right?
And being outside the hotel is no go. So having the motorcycle inside the hotel is a way of having a certain amount of mobility and autonomy within the confined space that he exists. But it is kind of weird, you know. It is sort of like the house in Beetlejuice, you know. These you can't leave,
yeah.
You know, you're stuck there.
It is kind of like the house in Beetlejuice, and that it's haunted by these seemingly intelligent creatures who no one ever notices, and who sort of rely on the random leavings of the people who come and go in order to survive. Also, Ralph can talk to ants, which I had forgotten about. Ants come show up. They poke their nose in a couple of little scenes, and Ralph's all, "Get out of here," and the ants leave. And I guess I just don't understand. I've read this book so many times, and I just am always confounded by it. It's such a bizarre book. Like, I guess for a kid, it's not. Like, when I was a little kid, I wasn't like, this is weird. But as I got older, I'm like, this book doesn't fit in, because she's written about animals before. We just read Ribsy, and that's about an animal, but he's not anthropomorphized at all. He's got ideas about how the world works. But this is a mouse and their family who, they just sit around. They're like the Littles. They just sit around and basically have a family structure, and they've got uncles and cousins, and they worry about things, but they die. Like, his father died because he found a pill on the ground and stored it in his cheek, where it dissolved and killed him. And that's a horrible way to die. He was poisoned to death. Like, there's a lot of just gloom and doom in this book, and Ralph sees himself as completely vulnerable, and he knows he has a short life. I don't know where to take this book. It's so weird.
You mentioned reading this as a kid and how you accept parts of the book as a kid. The thing that I never really accepted, and I must have read this around the age of 7 or 8, I think. The thing that I did not accept was the idea that you could make the motorcycle move just by making a boom sound with your lips or whatever. And how is he? It's like it's spelled
PBBBBBBB, which is, I think is supposed to be, okay, try reading this out loud to a kid and having to do this every time it comes up. The sound, I think, is supposed to be.
Yes. Right.
And A, that's hard to do for a long time. B, mice don't have lips. C, I agree with you. Like, it doesn't.
But as a kid, I didn't accept that. But I had no trouble at all with the idea that Ralph could talk to Keith. Mm. I guess because I had read so many stories in which animals talk to people.
Right.
You know, I just kind of, like, it seemed like, okay, this is an accepted
trope. Well, it's
trope.
Because you know what your toys are capable of doing. Like, there's no amount of magic can change the fact that your Transformers can't transform by themselves, your Hot Wheels can't go around the track by themselves, like, your G.I. Joe's not going to come down off the counter and talk to you. Like, yeah, there it's as strange as it seems, it's straining credulity. It's making, is this magical realism? Is that what this is? Is this Beverly Cleary's magical realist novel?
Well, I think that's it's fascinating to me that Cleary obviously did not care to give an explanation. The explanation of this book is a real, I'm not going to waste any time coming up with some sort of a convoluted explanation for why he magically is able to ride a motorcycle. And this is the way that Cleary approaches fantasy, because the whole story is a fantasy in the first place. It's sort of like there's a line up to which she will go. It's like, okay, I'll have talking mice, but I'm not going to have the motivation of the story be a magical wish. I'm not going to have there be some sort of a magical spell that they find that causes this. You know, there's a million and one reasons you could give that a toy motorcycle might, you know, be able to propel itself, and they all involve some sort of a fantastical supernatural explanation. So her supernatural explanation is he just wants it badly enough.
Yeah. And I guess that's why I'm like, obviously this is not magical realism, but it sort of fits into that mode because it works because it is supposed to. Like that's what you're left with. It's like the reason the motorcycle goes is because Ralph is doing it right. And that's it. Like he's doing it right. And he can teach it to other mice if they understand how to do it correctly. And you're like, all right, I guess like the toy works because he knows how to do it. And that's, she doesn't leave us with anything more than that. It would, I guess if she had been like, Matt was an ancient wizard and he gives the boy a magic motorcycle. And if any animal touches this motorcycle, you'll be able to talk to them and they can ride it. Like that would have fit perfectly in another author's world. But I feel like if Beverly Cleary had written that, it would have like broken Beverly Cleary's like career. Like it would have been too far out there. Like she's playing her cards close to the chest because that's kind of how she does it. Like this makes internal sense. I can justify all of Beverly Cleary's novels taking place within the same universe, except for these. Do these take place like in the same same realistic universe as all of her other books?
I don't think so. But on the one hand, the setting she's chosen for her setting, places she knows. This is obviously some place in Northern California. It's the same western mountainous forested area that she writes about throughout most of her books. So there's a similarity of geography. This is about children coming of age in some way. It takes place in a recognizable world where some of the motivating factors are what the socio-political and economic situation are, because this is again a story about the parents moving by car. It's very much set up to kind of like be this mid-60s story.
Yeah.
So there is this kind of a weird realism that runs through all that. And to the extent that Ralph has a psychological, you know, his psychology is also motivated by, as we've said, his desire for autonomy, his desire for responsibility, his desire to be taken seriously. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, the one thing I would say that feels very unreal to me is Ralph's family. They just seem to sit around the hole all day,
yes,
like worrying. Well, that's all they do. They're like non-player characters. They just sit there and they, you poke them and they say the same dialogue over again.
I was going to say it in a weird way. It feels like she somehow tapped into an ethnic stereotype that we didn't know existed. like about mice. Like she's writing mice in a racist way, almost in like a broad derogatory. Oh, this is what a mouse mother is like. This is what mice uncles are like. You know, this is what mouse cousins do. And I'm writing this sort of like broad stereotype of mice. You guys know what they're like, but it's mice. Like it's not a thing. It's like, but she has very firm ideas about what a mouse family is like.
Well, in a way, it makes a sort of a sense insofar as actual mice have lots and lots of children.
Uh-huh.
They have enormously large families, and most of those do not survive long. Most of them are killed off in gruesome and horrible
yes.
ways. And so if you take that reality of life and then you impose a human psyche onto uh-huh. that, you know, there's you get this situation where the mom is just in perpetual worry about everything.
Right. I mean, and more so in the later books, which we will see, the dynamic of this extended family and Ralph's relationship to the family and how he's perceived by his family is a strong motivating factor for what he does. He's like they all depend on Ralph. It seems they depend on Ralph to make deals with the humans so that they can get better food. But they are quick to turn on him when he makes a mistake. And as we're going to in the future books, we'll see like their relationship with his motorcycle is going to become a major sticking point for Ralph himself. But yeah, see, she has firm ideas about what, but it's not watership down. As life or death as it is, like these are still like cartoon mice. They're not like, they're not like using like strange made up terminology for the world. Like they understand what a mousetrap is and what a yeah.
Well, speaking of cartoon mice, do you want to talk about the made for TV movie?
Do you mean the made for TV movie directed by Ron Underwood, future director of Monk and Pluto Nash?
Well, yeah, why, yes, I do. So, starring Ray Walston of stage and screen,
Director of City Slickers and Heart and Souls. And Tremors. So yeah, this is the made for TV ABC weekend special. Now, I don't know if you are familiar with the ABC weekend specials.
This came along after my time when
Did
I
it?
Was a kid. I'm very familiar with the after school specials of the 70s.
Yeah, this
and
is
80s. I think that this is kind of like that.
This is a spinoff
for your generation.
So they started in 77.
Okay.
These are the weekend specials, and they were basically after school specials, but made for Saturday morning, and usually based on pre-existing children's books, like Homer Price. They had a Homer Price episode where it was Homer and the Wacky Donut Machine. It was,
you know, I think I saw that one.
Yeah. And so they would adapt these children's books and other things into 30-minute or hour-long specials to see on Saturday morning. And in 1986, they did, with Ron Underwood, directed The Mouse and the Motorcycle. And I watched this thing when it first aired and recorded it. Like, I recorded it on VHS, and I watched this thing countless times. I was somewhat obsessed with this adaptation of The Mouse and the Motorcycle. And I believe it's the first television adaptation of any kind of Beverly Cleary property.
I'm trying to remember this. She gave an interview somewhere where she talked about this adaptation and talked about it being that after that, she wanted to have more control over things.
Which is funny because this is a pretty faithful adaptation of The Mouse and the Motorcycle.
Yeah, it's pretty straight.
Yeah, a lot of the dialogue is lifted. There's not a whole lot of indulgence because that was the point of the ABC specials. Like, they were trying to do a fairly faithful adaptation of the work. And it is almost faithful to a fault because, well, so you had never seen it before. What are your...
No, I had never seen it before. And I have to say, first of all, The choice of Ray Walston as Matt just underscores to me how weird the character of Matt is.
Uh-huh.
Because having such a well-known... I mean, Ray Walston to a younger generation. You may know him from the stuff he did on like Northern Exposure and stuff, but he's been around forever, and he was in the original Broadway cast of Damn Yankees.
Yeah.
And, I mean, he's a pretty major deal as far as actors go. It's kind of strange to see him in this role. You see him, you're like, oh, that's Ray Walston. And he's a good enough actor that he kind of commands that scene of like, just, hi, I'm Matt, you know,
yeah,
you know, if you need anything. And you think, oh, keep an eye on this guy, he's going to be
exactly
to the plot. And then he just disappears.
Yep. I mean, as a kid, when I saw this the first time, I was like, hey, that's my favorite Martian, because I used to watch old reruns. I was like, oh my God. I was like, oh, my favorite Martian's in this. What are they going to do with Matt? And you're right. Like, he greets the family. He says hello to the mouse at one point. He brings you back a motorcycle. Like, that's it. But he's such a good actor that he's like, oh, I found this in the laundry. Does this belong to somebody? And you're like, oh, like, such gravitas. Like, he's such a grand actor.
But the other thing that I will say, and it has to be said, is that Ralph is played by a combination of puppets that are just everything shot in frame, mm-hmm, and then stop motion. And the stop motion version of Ralph, they made some very strange choices with him. Mostly, they gave him humanly proportioned arms because I think that the animators wanted to have something to emote with. You know, it's difficult, perhaps, to get a lot of nuance and expression in a stop-motion face.
Right.
So they rely a lot upon hand gestures to show how excited Ralph is at any moment. And it looks horrific. The minute I saw it, the first thing I thought was the Sumatran rat monkeys from Dead Alive or Brain Dead, however you want to call it.
Peter Jackson film.
The Peter Jackson, yes.
No, he does strike you as something that would rise from the sea in a Ray Harryhausen movie. Like, his arms seem to have about 10 joints each. Like, they fold and flail in very odd ways. I think it had to do also with the fact that they kind of like tried to ride this line between, like, we want this to look like a real mouse. Like, we don't want it to look like a cartoon mouse. So we'll keep it as mouse looking as possible, but give it like little beady eyes and a pointy, but also like, let's also split the difference because we want it to be able to express itself. So we'll give it like bizarre legs and these like creepy, the arms each are about like as the length of its body. Like, they're these hugely long arms. Plus, they had to make this thing be able to sit on a motorcycle, which I don't know if you've seen a mouse in recent years, but they're not designed to sit on motorcycles, nor are motorcycles designed to allow a mouse to ride them. So they had to give it really long legs so it could reach the pedals and like it could bend its elbows and also speak in some kind of, they manipulate the voice so it sounds, yeah, like it's some kind of horror show. And as a kid, I understood this was bad special effects. Not to like slag on it too much, like with a television budget, they get away with some stuff. Like, they do stop motion and you see this mouse riding its motorcycle around, and there's a scene where like he peeks up out of the boy's shirt and you realize that like, oh, all the puppetry is in miniature. Like, these are little tiny mouse puppets that they're like manipulating off camera. And I think they do their best, and the acting is fine. Like, the adults do a decent job for, like, you know, like ABC Saturday Morning. It's shot, there's like a crane shot from like the ground floor up through the upper window that I was like, oh, like, wow, they got a crane in here to like work this to get this camera up. Like, they were I'm going to credit the director, was trying for something. Like, he wanted this thing to look like a watchable TV movie.
Yeah, I mean, I'm impressed by the amount of work that went into it for a one-off show for kids, mm-hmm, to invest the amount of time that it must have taken to do that amount of stop motion to, you know, the to create the puppets and to, you know, just to dress the set in here. It must have been a fairly substantial budget as far as TV budgets went at the time.
Yeah.
But oh my God. I mean, they put Ralph's voice, they put it through modulation. they changed the pitch, and then they put it through like a flanger or something like that, some sort of a, like, as if it was going through some sort of a preamp.
Yeah.
And someone was just like playing with the settings on that. And you know what it sounds like to me? I don't know if you remember back in the 90s, the early 90s, their MTV tried for a while to do animated shows, and they had the Max, and they had the Brothers Grunt and terrible things like that. And they had a show called The Head.
Oh, yeah.
And there was a demon that came out of the titular head in The Head who had basically Ralph's voice. And I can't remember what the demon's name was. I don't really want to look it up. It wasn't that great a show, but that's probably what's coloring my impression of Ralph.
It's shrill and tinny, and yeah, it does sound like it's been through like 100 layers of modulation. To what end? I don't know, because it doesn't need it. Now, Ralph's mother and Ralph's uncle are voiced by Zelda Rubinstein, who doesn't need any voice modulation, and Billy Barty, who also doesn't need much voice modulation. So I don't know if they're both like, well, we got to make the voice of Ralph, Evan Richards, sound like he's a little person or something. I don't know what they were trying to do, but he also has a weird accent at one point. Like, you get a little, he's doing a little bit of, this, like, what are you doing? Like, but you can't really hear it because of all the modulation, but it peeks through like every once in a while. It's very unnerving and very distracting.
Yeah, I get the feeling that he was modeling this slightly after the kinds of voices that Mel Blanc would do, which drew heavily upon like Brooklyn, mid-century or earlier accents. And I don't know why, because this is not taking place on Long Island. This is taking place in California.
Well, he was the actor himself was in the movie Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Oh. He also played the same character in the TV series of Down and Out in Beverly Hills. He also was in the TV series of Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure playing Bill S. Preston Esquire. So not only does he has a habit of doing television adaptations of pre-existing works, but I'm going to assume that like he was kind of known for playing a wise guy, like,
right.
And so I assume that they were like, yeah, just do what you do. Like, you're a stage actor, you've done some roles, like, just put a little personality into this mouse. So he does it, and then I'm sure he sees the finished product, and he's like, you can't even tell it's me. Like, it's just, but I believe he went on to do Ralph's voice through. Well, maybe he only did. It looks like he only did it for this one adaptation. I guess they got a different mouse actor for the other adaptations, because they did all, I believe, all three books as television movies. But it's for anyone who wants to see it, you could just go on YouTube. It is easily findable. Do you have anything else to add about the mouse and the motorcycle?
Well, the only thing I would say about that is, just as with the book, the way that people have told me, oh, I'm looking so forward to when you do this on the podcast, the book, I have heard people talk so fondly of this particular TV production. And to me, it seems odd and creepy. But I suppose, we have a certain amount of fondness for things that strike us as odd as children. I think that's an important thing. You know, when I was a kid, I saw a very strange animated film that I have never been able to find. It's called I Am the Devil. For many years, I wondered whether I had just made this up. You know, these were in the days. I'm going to go into one of my tangents. These were in the days when there were only three channels on TV, and whenever you wanted to see a movie, you'd either have to see it in the theater, or I got to see a lot of movies that got shown at the local college by renting them from this, you know, like Swank, if you remember what Swank was a company that rented out like 16 millimeter versions of films that were out of circulation. And I saw this film, And I could not believe it was so weird and psychedelic and upsetting and distressing. And it had nudity in it and it had cursing in it. And I couldn't believe I had seen this thing. So for many, many years, I wondered if I had actually seen this film. And then, like, when the internet came along, I thought, oh, this is great. I'm sure it will be on YouTube. And I couldn't find it on YouTube. I couldn't find it anywhere. I'm like, oh, this maybe it is something I made up in my mind. And then one day I found a link to a gallery that was selling an original poster for this. And that's the only thing I've ever found to confirm in my mind that this exists. But my weird circuitous point to this whole story is you see things when you're a kid, and I think it's the odd things, the things that don't quite fit into your worldview that stick with you. You know, you kind of treasure those things. I think everyone remembers the first film that they saw that was really terrifying. And so The Mouse and the Motorcycle, that was 86. I was already in college by the fall of 86. So this was a little too late for me. But I remember seeing, like, The Phantom Tollbooth, the Chuck Jones adaptation of that. And that stuck with me for being a weird, funky, strange adaptation that for a long time.
I, of course, grew up enough with the TV adaptation that it, I mean, my memories of it were vivid. And when I watched it again the other day, I was like, yep, that's exactly how I remember it. But I know what you mean. It's fleeting. And something like this TV movie is fleeting enough that I can see people watching it not often, like just catching it or maybe being shown it in class. And then that's it. Like, it's not like people are going around today. It's not like the movie Hocus Pocus, where everyone's like, this is the greatest movie ever made. And they have just T-shirts and you can go to, like, Hot Topic and buy, like, mini skirts with the pictures on it. No, The Mouse and the Motorcycle TV movie is a piece of mostly forgotten pop cultural ephemera that maybe, like, Ray Walston completists are, like, crazy about, but that I think people remember as maybe being better than it was. Not to say that it's terrible, but it is what it is. It's a made for TV adaptation of a what would otherwise be highly special effects demanding children's story. Why they didn't just animate it, I don't know, because that seems like a no brainer for something like this. So I assume that you have a copy with the original Lewis Darling illustrations.
Yes, I do. Well, I have a mid-90s paperback, so it has one of these strange sort of almost photorealist covers.
Yeah.
And then the interior are all the Lewis Darlings.
Yeah. And how does he draw the mouse on the motorcycle? Does he
He does a fairly believable job of making the mouse fit on the motorcycle, partly because the motorcycle, he makes the mouse and the motorcycle about the same size.
Yeah.
So Ralph isn't, you know, he doesn't have to, like, stretch himself to fit as much on other. So it works. I think the Darling illustrations are, by themselves, some of the best illustrations he's done. They have a kind of a looseness and modernity to him. I mean, Darling sometimes becomes crazily sketchy, and Darling often likes to have a focal point that's very highly wrought, and then everything else is in extremely thin ink lines, and he does that all the time in this book, and it's just, it's great. And there's, like, the scene where the maid is holding the wastebasket away from her is hilarious. And I really do recommend anyone who can get their hand on these illustrations take a look through them, because they are.
I have the edition great. By obviously illustrated by Tracy Dockray, and I know Tracy Dockray a lot. Like, Tracy Dockray is just doing her. I assume Tracy Dockray is a woman, right? Okay, Tracy Dockray, she's doing her job, and she's doing it the best you can. Sometimes I feel bad about ragging on her. I mean, we're comparing it to Lewis Darling, which is just, you can't win that fight. Some of the illustrations in Tracy Dockray's, I find charming. I think she seems comfortable drawing cartoon mice, but then at other times they just look, it looks like she's not comfortable drawing cartoon mice. I'll just put it that way. Like, some of them seem very like almost Don Bluth inspired. And then some of them are just cartoon mouse heads on top of other mouse heads. If you can get a copy of the Lewis Darling, I'm looking at the illustrations right now. And they are gorgeous. Like, these are some gorgeous, gorgeous pictures. So, yeah, I do have one final note to make about this book, if I may. When in elementary school, we had to do read a book and then do a project on it. Every kid got to read whatever book they wanted to do. I don't remember what I did. One kid did The Mouse and the Motorcycle, and we had to do posters of our books where we drew a picture that was from the book. And one of the kids did Mouse and the Motorcycle, and their poster was obviously they or a parent or someone, I don't know who, just copied one of the Lewis Darling illustrations, like exactly. And I was so angry that they had cheated at their work that I told the teacher on them, and I got in trouble for tattling on a fellow student because the teacher was like, "You need to pay attention to your own work." But whenever I see, is there a picture in the Lewis Darling's book where Ralph is rolling or holding the aspirin?
Oh yes.
Okay, then that's the one, and they totally just ripped it off and drew that copied that picture. Exactly, and I got in trouble for being a snitch, being a tattletale. So if the kid I tattled on is listening, I'm sorry. If the teacher brought it up to you, that was me. That was my bad.
This book did teach you a lesson after all.
It really did. It really did. Just mind your own business. Just mind your own business. I hope people who've been waiting for this episode feel like we did it justice.
Well, next time we're going to turn to Mitch and Amy, which is a book I've never read.
Oh my God, really? I've never read that either. I have no idea what it's about. I'm glad we're going to
find out.
You know what? I have not gotten any emails from anyone asking when we're getting to Mitch and Amy. Maybe it'll be a pleasant surprise for both of us.
But you know what looms after Mitch and Amy, of course.
No, I don't.
Ramona the Pest.
Never heard of it. Can't wait to get to it.
Okay, well, till next time then.
Till next time.
ClickitCast is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com.